Okay.
I'm sorry. That's quite intentional. Well, my name's Terry, and I'm an alcoholic. And I closed the door because 1,000 years ago, my father did a chair at a mini convention in Norham Gardens in Oxford, which had exceptionally good amplification, and he spoke very clearly, and he broadcast his chair to half of Oxford. And I wouldn't want to inflict what I have to say on the good burghers of Reading. I'm not just an alcoholic, I'm clearly an old man, a dozy old geezer. And the relevance of that is that, it'll come as no surprise to you, nothing works like it used to. I've been wearing glasses to read for 30 years. I'm going very deaf. My wife frequently complains about the sound of the television and comes in and turns it down to what she calls a normal level, and I can't hear it. But I will not tell the bitch that I'm going deaf. I say, don't be daft, my hearing's perfect. My brain is shot. My memory is pathetic. If I'm being generous, if I'm being boastful, my memory is pathetic. And because of the ladies here, I won't tell you about the ailments going south. But they can be very embarrassing and ineffective. But the one thing that hasn't changed is my instinct. My instinct is sharper than ever. So I can spot the funny look in the eyes of people heading in my direction, looking for me to talk. And I immediately go on the alert. They either got that slightly furtive look in their eyes, sort of, psst, psst, want to buy some dirty photos. Or they had this sort of cult-like enthusiasm. Nothing personal. And as soon as they start heading in my direction, I go into defense mode and just quickly go through the reasons why I'm sorry, but I'm not able to do that. And the first thing I heard from these two very presentable young men was the word Sunday. Now, I don't go out on Sundays. I really don't go out on Sundays. Because for the first 17 years of my recovery, I worked in the license trade, which would seem an odd thing to do, but eunuchs make the best guards of harems and teetotalers run the best bars. And I therefore worked 6 days a week. So Sunday was my day off. But to compound matters, after about 6 months, I was put into service. As Anne said, you didn't volunteer for service in those days. You were told you're doing the teas for the next 6 months, start next Tuesday or whatever. And so 5 years worth of intergroup service and 5 years on the Cambuslands National Convention and then a few years up in New York, I was away for a lot of Sundays. So as a reaction to that, I don't go out on Sundays. So when these young men, I heard them say Sunday, I thought, no, won't be going. And then I heard Reading. Christ, I can't find my way around Reading. It's a nightmare. 50 years ago, you could find your way around Reading, but the town planners managed to screw all that up. So I thought, right, I'm going to let them down gently. And then they used two magic words, Tom G and Babs. And I had no choice. I had to be here. Those old-timers had a magic which manifested itself in the time and attention and compassion that they showed to me. And Babs was a great lady. I didn't know her as well as I knew Tom, but she was just a wonderful, wonderful lady. And it was a privilege to know her. Tom was special to me. He was a man of awesome humility, deep, deep gratitude, and great kindness. And not only am I an alcoholic and an old man, I'm a bit of a scruffy Herbert as well. I only shave about 2 times a week, and I only wear ties for weddings and funerals. Clearly, more often funerals than weddings at my age. But it's my little tribute to Tom that I would tart up a bit today, because he was also very dapper. I drew the line at the Brill Cream and the band leader's 1940 band leader's moustache, but this is my way of saying, Tom, big respect. Those old timers were brave, brave people, you know, because things were different then. There was very little knowledge about alcoholism. there were still musical acts touring the UK where the act was impersonating a drunk. We were people who lacked willpower. We were people who lacked moral fibre. We were inferior people. We were flotsam. And it was one thing to join AA. It was another thing to nail your colours to the mast publicly by telling doctors, "Can I help?" or the police or prison authorities, "Can I help?" Things were much, much tougher then. There were far, far, far fewer meetings than there are today. Of course, we're talking about long before the mobile phone, and so no emails, no texts, but not everybody could afford a phone. I remember when we didn't have a phone. Not that many people could afford cars. Things were much, much tougher. But do you know what? The trade-off for that was, and I loved the Fellowship of 2014. It's the centerpiece of my life. It's what keeps me sober. It's what gets me up in the morning, gets me to sleep at night. But in those days we had, because there were fewer of us, and it was harder, there seemed to be a greater camaraderie. It was a magic, a joy. And I'm not making any comments on today's generation, but if one of us fell by the wayside metaphorically, we gathered round them. We did not cross the road and go on to our meeting. It was a wonderful, wonderful time. And I pray in the morning, and I pray in the evening, and I pray for certain old-timers that I will name later. And every 2 years, I update my address book. I change my address book. And I still write down the names and numbers of many of the people whose names you've heard today. Because unashamedly, for me, they live on. They live on in my heart. They live on in my head. So why should I take them out of my book? Simply because they've gone to the great celestial meeting in the sky. And I won't be seeing them locally. They were special. When I was 16, my dad put down the glass and joined AA. And I picked up the glass. And I lived at home between 16 and 18. And every Friday and every Monday, members of AA would come to the house for coffee, sandwiches, whatever. And I liked them. But they were also bloody old. They are as old as I am today, and I knew, therefore, I would never, ever, ever be joining AA. Clearly, I wasn't going to have a drinking problem either, because you reject the behavior of your parents and you try to do it differently, better yourself, and invariably you fail. And so I set off on a journey that was to last 14 years, and I won't tell you too much about the journey, because it's a different sort of meeting today. I'm not one of these people who knocks drunkologues. I know they went out of fashion about 20, 25 years ago, to which I say, and I know this is being taped, bollocks. It's an integral part of my life, and how can a newcomer who's 4 months old identify with 35 years sober? He can identify with the shame, the guilt, the vomiting, the punch-ups, the failures, the ruined relationships. And anyway, selfishly, I need to remind me of how it was. It's just too long ago. I can no longer taste the vile taste of bile and dry vomiting. And that was a regular start to the morning for me. It's 40 years since I slept in a wet bed. I need to be reminded of how it was. I carry physical scars because I was a great puncher. But I also carry the mental, emotional, and spiritual scars, and I need to be reminded of that. And so, at the end of a 14-year journey, I was a broken man. But before I go into that, let me tell you about my attempts over the last 10 years of that journey not to join AA. The first one was what I thought was religion, Western religion. And I would, what I thought was pray, which was, whenever I was in trouble, I would say to a concept that I did not believe in, please, please, God, get me off this court appearance or whatever, and I'll try and be a better boy. And of course, the prayers were never answered. So I was getting pretty cynical about Western religion when I decided on the spur of the moment to go to a Billy Graham rally in Earl's Court. He was at the height of his powers at the time. The problem was, I was very, very pissed. And so within about 10 minutes of the great man starting, I passed out. I mean, I can't say I fell asleep, I passed out. And when I came to, the great man had gone, and so had everybody else except the cleaning staff, and it was me. And we're all a bit bonkers, and I was very bonkers. I subconsciously crossed off Western religion as a solution. However, there was help at hand. And about that time, just a year later, the Beatles released Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and oh God, this takes huge courage to admit. I decided I would try the Eastern approach, so I bought the caftan. Oh, the shame, the shame, the shame. It's the equivalent to Frank's amaretto, this. And the beads, and the bells. And I discovered drugs, as well as alcohol, as a consequence of that. So we crossed that off. The coup de grace was I was at an ashram where Ravi Shankar was the highlight of the thing, and he was talking all about frugality and poverty. And he did this. And just then I saw a solid gold Rolex, and I thought, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. He's talking about poverty and frugality, and there's a sort of £10,000 watch on his wrist. Now, forget this. So we tried other things. We tried willpower. Fleet Street used to say we were weak-willed. I'm not weak-willed. I have an iron will. I had an iron will then, and I would use that iron will to take me off for a day, or a week, or a month, or whatever. The difference is, I always went back, and it got worse, and worse, and worse. I tried bets for sums of money that I couldn't afford, and I always lost them. It was desperate. The only two emotions I knew in the last 4 years were what a Tweely and Coily refers to as resentment. For that, read incandescent rage. And the other very attractive emotion was buckets and buckets of nauseating self-pity. My idea of a great night out was to stay in with a bottle of scotch and some Leonard Cohen and Neil Diamond records and a box of Kleenex, and then all drinking alcoholics' best friends, the telephone. And no calls that were worth making were worth making before midnight. And I used to call. I'm sure I'm not the only person in this room who did behave like this. I used to call victims. There were no other way to describe them. And not everybody went, go away. Some listened to me talking complete bollocks and garbage and weeping and raging down the phone. And nothing changed. And about 9 months before the end, I went to a doctor. She knew me well, and she specialized in alcoholism addictions. And she said to me, look, I know you people don't respond to fear tactics. You're all members of the world's most unexclusive club, the It Couldn't Happen to Me Club. But truly, you will be dead in 6 months if you don't stop, if you don't go to AA. And I walked outside, and I can remember this so clearly, thinking, well, that wasn't really a huge surprise. I'm not enjoying life. I've destroyed all that I loved, all the relationships that were important to me. I've destroyed my career. I'm broke. I have no hope. I'll die. So be it. That's okay. And I went to the pub and I got pissed. What else would you do? What else would you do? I mean, I was so crazy, I thought, well, it's quite a romantic thing to do. Jim Morrison died young. Jimi Hendrix died young. Janis Joplin died young. Keats, Shelley, they died young. And this oik will die young. So be it. Now we fast forward that by about 35 years, and in November 2009, much to my surprise, in an appointment at the John Radcliffe Hospital, they stuck a needle twice into my throat and drew off fluid and came back to me 10 minutes later and said, "Sorry, mate, you've got cancer and it's quite advanced." Boom! My head exploded. And driving home was difficult. And that night was incredibly emotional. Telling my daughters was a heartbreaker. And telling my wife things I should have told her 1,000 times in the last 35 years, was difficult. But the next day I woke up and I thought, am I going to allow this situation to move center stage, to run my life? And I thought, to hell with that, I'm not. I'm going to use the program of AA. It's there not just to keep me from that first drink one day at a time. It's there to give me a program for living. And so I locked myself for the next year, artificially, rigidly, into a high-intensity fellowship program. And so I artificially lived just one day at a time. I dare not look ahead, because I might see a little black van from the co-op heading for the house with my name on it. So I focused on the day. I wrote a gratitude list each day. And it was a completely honest list. And it cited the reasons I had to be grateful. Like the gift of sight. Imagine not being able to see a sunset. The gift of hearing. Imagine not being able to hear music. The gift of friends, real friends, not bullshit friends. The gift of peace of mind. The gift of a clear conscience. The gift of a roof over my head. Half the world hasn't got that. The gift of food in the larder. The gift of my marriage. The gift of my children. It just went on and on and on. And so each day, the page was full and there was no room for, oh, Christ, I might be dead in 4 months. And that worked immensely. I upped my meetings. I used the telephone a lot. And the relevance of all of this is, and I am not only an old man and an alcoholic, I'm a coward. I'm very brave with a bottle of whiskey in me and a weapon in my hand. I'm a coward on Coca-Cola. But I never had a day's fear. Not one day's fear as a result of the program, not me. Let me define fear. Did I have problems going to sleep? Never. Did I have problems going to sleep in the middle of the night because gentlemen my age get their exercise walking to the loo? They don't go to gymnasiums. There's the once or twice or three nightly hop down the corridor. Nope. Went back to sleep like a baby. When I could eat, did I go off my food? Absolutely not. And so at the end of this year, when the oncologist said to me, well, after 2 MRI scans, I have good news for you, Mr. C. You're now completely clear of cancer. And your prospects look good. I didn't go, yeah! I just got up. I shook his hand. I said, thank you very much. I went home. There was no champagne opened by my family. Mind you, that may be a reflection of my wife's feelings for me. She even went out and bought the hat for the funeral during the year I had cancer. She did. Oh, by Christ, she did. There was no special meal. There was no going to a restaurant. It was just another day. Just as I've been taught to live, a day at a time. Now, I've talked about these old timers and how special they were to me and still are. And each morning I pray with the word please. And each night I pray with the words thank you. And the very last of my prayers is, please, sir, if it is your, thank you, dear God, for the gift of the many great, great, great men and women who enriched my life and gave me the gift of recovery. Folk-like. And I may get emotional here. And many of you won't know these names, some will. And they go in this order, and there's no particular reason for the order, it's just the pattern that it's been for many years. Pat B. Pat B. A legend. Next to Barry, I don't know anybody else who gave so much away, who did so much 12-stepping. He was a lion of a man, a titan of recovery. We were together for 22 years, and I was his sponsor from day one till his last day. And I say this with no mock humility. After 4 or 5 years, I started to learn from him rather than him from me, and I learned so much from that man for the rest of his life. Patrick D., APD, my father, great, great man. My father 12-stepped him into recovery, and my father 12-stepped his father into recovery. And so about 6 months before the end of my journey as a drinking alcoholic, I'm given to understand, I discovered this years later, my father said to him, "You owe me. Go and get him." And so, being a dutiful lad, and as others will tell you, you didn't cross my father. If he, a request was a directive. And so he started to do horrible, terrible things. Things I could sue him for today, for harassment. He started to telephone me. And he started to say really offensive things like, "I'm going to a meeting. Shall I pick you up?" "Go away!" Boom! But we're not stupid. I wised up to this, so I stopped answering the phone. So he started to come and knock on the door. So I had a spy hole fitted. But he was relentless, and it was a December or January night he knocked on the door, and he just wouldn't go away. So in the end, I took off over the fields out the back. And I fell eventually into this ditch full of water and nettles. And as I walked back to the house, cold, wet, stinging, I never thought for 1 minute I'd made the wrong decision. That was the right decision, rather than going to AA. Next person I pray for is the Bishop of Wantage, Barry. God bless him. There's a synergy between that family and mine that goes back 50-odd years. It really is a long, long time. Anne talked about my father and mother. And we've had many great times together. Been to parties, weddings, funerals together. Barry spoke at my mother. He did the eulogy at my mother's funeral. And I tragically had the honor of doing the eulogy at Barry's funeral. Barry was a great man. If ever anyone personified the joy of recovery, it was Barry. It wasn't a serious business. Of course it was a serious business, deep, deep down. But he understood the power of laughter. My God, the power of laughter is awesome. And the power of love. And then next to Barry, I talk about Tom G., Black Tom, Irish Tom. He was a man who personified keeping it simple, and he was a man who believed in this fellowship with a passion. When I was about 6 months in, he took me by the lapels of my blazer, different blazer, by the way, and he smacked me against the door. And I hated him. But he was right. I made the wrong decision. He was right. Tom G. used to live in Amersham. And as Anne was saying, there weren't any meetings around in those days, and the nearest meeting to him was Aylesbury. And Tom had no money, and he used to walk from Amersham to Aylesbury for 17 miles and hope that somebody would give him a lift home. Talk about go to any lengths to get to a meeting. He was a wonderful man. Wonderful man. I spoke at his funeral as well, so I advise you not to talk to me, because I'll end up doing your eulogies if you're not careful. I'm sort of Dr. Death, where I turn up, you're on your last days. And then after that, I pray for Alex. Alex was a pilot who used to fly around the royal family from time to time, but in between doing that, he used to drink in the woods. Because he preferred to drink in the woods, because he preferred the company when he was drinking squirrels and rabbits rather than human beings, although he'd meet the odd wacko there as well. And he was a man who did so much service, it wasn't true. He was a great, great guy. And he could appear to be dour, but there was always a twinkle in his eye. He was a great, great man. And then Cyril. Cyril, who kind of lit the scene up in Bicester. A great, great man, Cyril. Cyril had to go and work in the Far East for many years when it was very tough to work in the Far East, and he still kept sober. He kept the tapes, he played tapes, he made the phone calls. And then I go on to Nora. Nora, God bless her. Old landlady, former chair lady of the Aylesbury Licensed Victualers Association, which had about the same powers locally as the Mafia. And she was formidable. She was lovely. She was absolutely lovely. She was very kind to me. She was maternal to me. She was wonderful. I saw her 4 days before she died. God bless her soul. I'm so glad I saw her, went to see her. And then a name, newer name, Sasha. Sasha was only 22 years when she died, but Sasha lived on the Bristol North Wales, South Wales border, and her home meeting was Beaconsfield. Now, how mad is that? How mad is that? It's got to be a 240-mile round trip. And I used to say to her, Sasha, for God's sake, get some meetings around where you live. This is where I get the biggest charge. This is where I feel happiest. And she said, I'd drive that way for a party. I'd drive that way for you. She was a great, great, great lady. And then I go into the really old Revive 45s. Freddie C. Freddie C was officially one of the world's top five trumpet players. He backed Sinatra. He played with Count Basie, Duke Ellington. And he got cancer. And he got cancer of the mouth. And he was never, ever able to play a trumpet again. And never once, ever, did I ever hear him complain. He became a journalist. He used to write quite often for Punch. And from time to time, he would send me clippings from Punch. And, you know, I hero worship this guy. This guy had been around since Noah, you know. And he was such a strong, good man. And he was paying attention to me, giving me kindness. What a man. Wick. Wick was fantastic. Wick had been on the first board of AA UK. He's co-founded the first meeting in London, First London. He was a merchant banker or something like that. He was always impeccably dressed, whether it was in the pinstripe or the tweeds. And I've never forgotten his shoes. I've never seen cleaner shoes in my life. I mean, you needed sunglasses in the summer with his shoes. But he never patronized me. He never talked down to me. But he showed me great, great kindness. Great kindness. He took an interest in me when I was, as I am now, nothing. And he gave me three huge, huge bits of advice. I mean, the wisdom of the man was mind-blowing. He asked me once, Terry, how do you allocate your time? And I said, well, that's easy, Wick. A third for my wife and children, a third for the business, and a third for AA. And I thought, Wick's going to be impressed with this. And he said, and where's the time in there for you? And it hit me between the eyes like a thunderbolt. If I don't put time in on me, I've got to sell myself short, which means I, in turn, sell short everything and all the people that I love. Wallop. Incredible. And after about 18 months in, I went to him and I said, Wick, he's in Beaconsfield, can I ask you some advice? He said, sure. I said, even though I was a drunk and a bit of a druggie, I used to be a bit of a Jack the Lad and have lots of girlfriends. And I don't want a relationship like that now. I want a relationship that has substance, that has meaning, rather than a 48-hour relationship. And he said, Terry, I'm a banker, and therefore I see balance sheets all the time. And I hope you won't think it's impertinent, but let me tell you what your balance sheet, the balance sheet you've created for you, it has 1,000 debits and not a single credit. And there isn't a balance sheet like that in the world. You must start to give yourself credit. Things, you must start to begin to learn to love yourself. Because if you don't begin to learn to love yourself, nobody else will love you. And 2 years later, I was married, and I'm still with the woman. My wife, I should say, not the woman. She's a tough woman, still is a tough woman, hasn't mellowed at all, I hope. And the last bit of advice he gave to me was, he said, Terry, you know, we don't wear rose-tinted glasses here. And I really had no idea what he was talking about. What on earth does he mean? He said, no. When you joined us, we invited you to join us and to begin to enter into something that has always terrified you. It terrified us all. It's called the real world. It's called reality. So you're going to have to throw away those real rose-tinted glasses like the rest of us and get into the real world. And he was right. And he said something along the lines, I'm paraphrasing it now, it's a long time ago, but he said, in the real world you're going to know some fantastic times and endless happy times and even more average times. You're going to know some poor times. You're going to know some bad times. And you're going to know some catastrophic times. That is the real world. But if you stick with us, we will give you the tools, the program, to deal with every single situation, whether it be good or bad. And he was right. He was 100% right. That small example I gave you of how I dealt with cancer, not saying I cured myself, but how it didn't run my life, was 100% programmed. Wick was right. And I think of Bill W. Not the Bill W., another Bill W., a Glaswegian scrap dealer, who was a character. The bastard was late for everything. In fact, I'll quick digression. The day before his funeral, there was a gale. And so the hearse was 20 minutes late getting to the crematorium because a tree had broken down, blown down, and while everybody was looking very somber, Herbie, the multi-tattooed guy, and I was screaming with laughter. Bill was late for his own funeral. He would have loved that. But Bill was an odd one. He didn't approve of service structures. He had no time for intergroup or region or the board. Thought steps were a sort of so-so. But you know, that man helped so many people. All he did, apart from nick the odd bit of scrap, was 12-step people. He turned Herbie into the great man he is, and Herbie only came to us initially to stay out of prison. And Herbie's still out of prison, and he's still with us 38 years later. 24/7, Bill was there for you. I was about 4 months into recovery when I got an urge, the first urge in 4 months, to take a drink. And I didn't have the honesty or the humility to say to anybody, I'm dying for a drink. But his was about the only number I didn't throw away. People kept giving me their numbers, and I'd say, thank you very much, and empty my pockets when I got home, chuck them away. I like them. I want to be with them, but why do I want to call them? And I had Bill's number, and he said, what are you doing? I said, nothing. He said, well, why don't you come over for a cup of coffee? I suspect he knew what was going on. And just get it driving over there, it began to lift. And within 10 minutes of being with another member of AA, a strong member of AA, it had gone. And that taught me so much. So very, very much. I learned that I had to have the humility to take on board not only what was suggested, but what was instructed by these old-timers. And the last person in no particular order, and I think probably only Anne will know him, Frank C. Wonderful, wonderful man. Wonderful man. He and I were at York at the same time, and York drove me to distraction. I wanted to machine gun people and burn GSO down. But Frank kept me sane because he had the most mischievous sense of humor. He really was the most non-judgmental man. He was such fun to be with. I mean, I learnt a lot from Frank, and I loved him very much. Great, great guy. And those old timers played and still play a key part in my life and in my recovery. They are with me every single day. So as I said, when I heard the name Tom G and Babs and I heard old timers, I had to throw away my obsession with staying at home on Sundays and be here. And selfishly, I've had a blast today. It's a small collection of people, but I've had a blast. Really, I feel so privileged, so thrilled to be here. And like many people, I owe this fellowship everything. Nothing more, nothing less, everything. And it's because of the old timers who were the pioneers in the early days, who set it up for others, like some of the people here, to take it on to the next stage and the next stage. And one day I'll be joining the gang in the celestial meeting in the sky, and I'm looking forward to seeing them very much. I really am. Thank you all very much indeed. God bless.